Weave us together, one great family, one beautiful tapestry, with all the different colorful threads into one loving whole. Thank you, God. So good evening, everyone. As Mike said, his talks came really quick. Mine had this nice long gap, and then suddenly here it is again. Oops. And so tonight, my topic is love, and it just kind of worked out that way. Mike said his two topics that he just did were on love, and I just happened to have my second topic on love, but I guess that's really no surprise, given that Jesus was all about love. As I mentioned in my first talk, as a child, I really loved the stories in the Bible about Jesus, and I felt that the most essential teaching he had was for us to love God and love one another as ourselves, that was the essence to me and still is of Jesus' teachings. I love the story that Mike shared this morning about Galatians, both the backstory, which I wasn't familiar with, and the Bible passage about Paul saying that Jesus came to tear down walls that we create to separate ourselves from one another, and thus to set us free. His reading about walls that the Galatians had built to separate themselves from those others reminded me of one of my favorite poems called Outwitted by American poet Edwin Markham. This poem says, "He drew a circle that shut me out, heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took him in." I'll read that again. I love this poem. "He drew a circle that shut me out, heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took him in." As I was preparing for these talks, I prayed for guidance about what to say. And it crossed my mind that I could have just pulled out the previous talks I gave at Lassen JFO and used them again, as most of you would not have heard them before. But that wasn't the guidance I got. So I prayed, I released, and waited for inspiration. And then one morning, as I was going out to my patio to have my cup of coffee and do my morning greeting of the day, I heard the words, "Love abides." I like that. I wasn't sure of all the ramifications, or even if I knew what the word abides means, but that was one of those bell ringer thoughts that kind of went, pay attention. So I looked up the word abides on Google, of course, and according to various sources, it means to continue without fading or being lost, or to accept or act in accordance with a rule, decision, or recommendation, as in, I abide in love. One of the comments on the website Reddit posed the question of what does the phrase, "the dude abides," mean? The response was, it was an iconic statement from the movie The Big Lebowski, which was intentionally vague in the movie, hinting at the fact that the dude lives on in his unperturbable state of dudeness somewhere, i.e., the dude endures or the dude lives on. Now, I have a tendency to go down rabbit holes when I'm researching. I don't know if you ever do that. You look up one thing and then something over here on the side looks interesting and you follow that and then 10 steps later and maybe 3 hours later, you kind of remember what you originally started to look at. So in this case, I thought, well, you know, I've never watched the movie The Big Lebowski, so maybe I should check that out and see if it has something I could use for this talk about love abides. Well, I don't know if you've ever watched it, but it's a typical Coen Brothers movie, and I don't think I'll be referring to it further. But I did find it entertaining. So then I turned to the Bible, wondering if that's where the phrase "love abides" comes from. Well, I couldn't find those exact words, but what I did find was in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 4, that says, One generation passes away, and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. I'm not sure that's exactly on point for the phrase love abides, but I thought I'd share it because I like to think of camp that way. And I'm sure, particularly in this camp that goes back so many generations, one generation passes away and another generation comes into being and comes into the camp fold, and love abides forever. Because after all, isn't that what truly brings us together, is love, and keeps us coming back to camp? I know it does for me. The wonderful, nourishing love that I receive and give back at camp. Love is one of those things that the more you give it away, the more you have. It kind of defies the laws of physics, I think, in that respect. Love abides. It continues without fading or being lost. It endures. It lives on. It lives in its unperturbable state of loveness, to paraphrase the dude from The Big Lebowski. I have come to believe that love is the most powerful force in the universe, at least in my very limited knowledge of the universe. Love can crack open the hardest heart and awaken long dormant love in its recipients. It is like the power of water. A slow drip of water through countless eons can wear down stone. It can reduce stone to its base components. It can create amazing cave formation when it seeps through limestone, or it can become beautiful snowflakes when it freezes. It is life-giving and can be powerfully destructive. Love endures. Something I didn't mention about me last night in my growing up years was that I was extremely shy as a child. That may be hard for some of you to understand or picture, but I was painfully shy. The thought of getting up in front of people terrified me. Anything I was doing as a child came to a screeching halt if it meant I had to stand up in front of people. So, for example, as a little girl, I was in Bluebirds, and I really loved it. And then our leader told us we were going to have a fly-up ceremony to become campfire girls. And I said, well, what does that do? What do we do? And she said, well, you'll stand up, we'll call your name, and you'll walk across in front of all the parents, and then you'll become a campfire girl. And I thought, nope, not going to do that. So I quit. Next came 4-H. I loved 4-H. I was in cooking and sewing, and my mother was my leader. And after 2 years of being in 4-H, they told me I had to do a demonstration if I wanted to stay in 4-H. And a demonstration meant I had to do some project and stand up in front of people and present it. And I thought, nope, I quit. So I did, I quit. And then I took ballet lessons, and I love ballet lessons. My sister and I, she's 14 months older than me, we rode our bikes together every Saturday morning to the ballet studio, and we did ballet lessons. She was a lot better than me, but I loved it. And then she told us we were going to have a recital. I thought, nope, I'm done, so I quit. Finally, in middle school, I wanted to be the school secretary. And to do that, I had to stand up in front of the student body and do a speech. And I wanted to be the secretary so badly, I finally overcame my fear and stood up and I made a speech and I got to be secretary. And then in high school, I did the same thing. So I could do that. I could stand up and say why people should vote for me for secretary. But I found it really difficult to articulate my inner thoughts, especially to someone who wasn't a really close friend. This was severely tested my first semester in college. All of our seminars, as I may have mentioned, were about 10 students and a professor. All of my basic units in college for the first 2 years were in these small seminar situations. And I only knew one person from my high school out of the 100 students that went through this program with me. During my first year, in the first semester, at the beginning of the term, our professor assigned us the task of identifying and writing down our 5 most basic beliefs. And if you've never done that, it's quite an interesting activity. And I gave this a lot of thought. One of my five basic beliefs I decided was that I believe there is a divine power in the universe, which we commonly refer to as God, but it was an intelligence and a being far more vast than the God of my childhood. It was a God that created the magnificence of the universe, and a God that vast, that mysterious, that amazing, was not the God of my childhood. It was a much bigger God, but I definitely believe that there was this divine intelligence and being, a loving being. Another basic belief was that we don't really know what truth is. We decide what truth is. We may be taught what truth is. We may learn what truth is through experience, but ultimately, we don't really know what truth is. We choose what we believe as truth. I forget what my other basic beliefs were, but I'm pretty sure one had to do with love. So we returned to the seminar having written down our five most basic beliefs, and we were all directed to put them in the center of the table, and the professor would pick one. Well, for some unknown reason, I wrote mine on lavender binder paper. Everybody else had yellow paper or white paper, but there was mine, this lavender piece of paper, and that's, of course, the one that the professor picked. So then he took my basic beliefs one at a time, and he read them out loud, and the class then proceeded to tear them apart. And of course, it became very evident whose beliefs they were because I was the one left there to defend them. And it was very, very hard for me. But they were my basic beliefs. I had come to a position of really knowing those were my beliefs. So I stood fast in those beliefs, but I felt really kind of ripped apart. And I was almost crying by the end of the seminar. And that's all we had time for, and that's all we ever did with any of those basic beliefs. So in our one-on-one meeting with my teacher, which we had to do every week, I told him I really didn't appreciate that project. I didn't appreciate being torn apart or having my basic beliefs under attack. But he told me that, he said, well, you know, I know that must have been difficult for you, but I want you to know that you probably have a better sense of who you are than anyone else in that seminar, including myself. So I appreciate the time and attention you put into that assignment. So that helped a little bit. So a year or two later in the same program, I took a seminar called Nonverbal Communications. It was, again, a group of about 10 students, and a few of them were, I would say, almost brilliantly smart and very articulate. They had read and understood all these books that we were reading about nonverbal communication, and so needless to say, I could barely understand what they were talking about, so I just kept my mouth shut. But in a seminar of 10 people, after a few weeks of not saying a word, it becomes kind of obvious that somebody's not contributing here. And I used to pour out my heart in a journal where it was just, it was my fear. The longer I didn't say anything, the more I thought I would be judged when I finally opened my mouth. And so then the pressure became even greater that whatever I said had to be really profound. And so I heaped all this pressure on myself and all this fear around being judged. And in looking back, I realized that that fear of being judged was the thing that made me so shy, and the thing that made it so hard for me to articulate my basic beliefs. I remember one time in high school, I was fretting about what to wear to a school dance, and my mother finally said, she was very practical, you know, I told you she came from the wheat fields of Manitoba, so she was very practical, and she said, you know, Diana, don't worry about it. Nobody's thinking about you anyway. They're thinking about themselves, so they're not going to be focused on what you're wearing anyway. That's probably true. It didn't really make me feel that great, but it was probably true. So I left off yesterday morning saying that I got my teaching credential. This was back in 1976, and I couldn't find a teaching job. And I made a pact with God that if I did everything I could but still didn't have a job by the end of the summer, I'd apply to go to law school. And so that's what I did. And the real reason I think that I wanted to go to law school was because I had all these thoughts in my mind, and I didn't feel I could really access them or speak them. And so I wanted to hone the instrument. I wanted to train my brain in logical thinking and be able to access what was going on in my mind and be able to speak it. So I went to law school. Now I want to share a kind of funny situation that happened years later, but it was a really fun little thing that happened. A friend of mine rented an apartment in Spoleto, Italy for 3 weeks. She attended a writing school for 2 weeks and invited me to spend the third week with her exploring the Umbria province of Italy. And so I wanted to see some of Italy, so I signed up for a tour. And this was, I'd never been on vacation by myself, but I went and flew to Italy by myself and joined up with this tour group. And on the boat taxi to our hotel, I met these two sisters from Texas, as well as our tour guide. And we got talking and met each other on this little taxi, water taxi. And then the two sisters invited me to walk around this island we were staying on, and so I got to know them. And so that night after dinner, the four of us plus one other woman joined us on the patio, and we stayed up late talking and laughing and drinking some wine and having a good time. And we were having some good, deep conversations, and one of the sisters, named Robin, was talking, and she was sharing something, and she was the shyer one of the two sisters from Texas. And so she was deep in this statement, and all of a sudden her sister Kim interrupted her and started talking, and Robin said, "Kim, I was talking," and Kim said, "I don't care," and she kept right on. And I thought, I like that, I don't care. Because I put so much stock in what other people thought of me that it was almost paralyzing sometimes. But if I could say to myself, I don't care what they think of me, then it was freeing. So I liked that. Another thing that happened that vacation was once my friend and I got together in Spoleto, she had rented a car, and there was a town we wanted to go visit called Gubbio. And so we headed off, and she had me looking at the map, and she was driving, and I couldn't find where we were on the map. This was before the days of GPS, and none of the streets were labeled, and if they were, they were in Italian, and I couldn't figure out where we were on this map, and we came to a T intersection. And she said, "Well, which way should we go?" And I said, "I don't know. I don't know where we are." And she goes, "Well, what does your gut tell you?" And I said, "It says go right." And she goes, "Me too. After all, how lost can we get?" And so that became another phrase that I really loved. When you're in a place of indecision, you just make a decision and you say, "Well, how lost can I get?" And I like that phrase too. So I mentioned the power of love and the commandment that Jesus told us to love God and love our neighbor as ourself. And I went to a women's retreat one time that was an interdenominational retreat that was held at a Catholic church. And there was one part where we were to go off by ourselves and do some silent prayer and meditation. And so I did. And we were to ask God, what is it that we need to learn? Well, I mentioned that sometimes when I go into meditation, it becomes very visual. I get a visual image of something. And in this case, I got a visual image of a little boy and his friends having a snowball fight. And there was this, like, snow cave that he had built. And I was that little boy, and we were having a snowball fight. And I went into this cave, and then I closed it off, and I felt very safe in there. And then a voice said, "Yes, you can be safe in here, but you closed yourself off to love. If you stay in here, you'll never have the opportunity to have love. So you need to come out of the cave." And so that was significant to me. You can't hide and be isolated and still experience the love that you get from other people and the love that you can give to other people. The other thing that happened in that meditation was that that voice said to me, you know, that commandment to love God and love your neighbor as yourself, there's three parts of that. Love God, love your neighbor, and love yourself. And that's really important because that's the foundation and the source for you being able to love God and love your neighbor. And so that was a really important lesson for me as well. Now, yesterday in our prayer prep, Carol mentioned the movie Won't You Be My Neighbor by Mr. Rogers. I don't know how many of you have seen it, but I just saw it a few weeks ago, and I absolutely loved it. I wasn't a Mr. Rogers devotee growing up because he was a little after my time, so I didn't really know much about him. But I could just see from the, it's a documentary about the Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, and I could just see the kindness and love that came through him on the screen. And that's all he wanted to do with children, is to let them know they were special and they were loved. And he just felt that that was such an important way that the new medium of television could be used, was to let children know they were loved. And he talked about emotions and things that kids were dealing with. He had studied early childhood development quite a bit. And there came a point at one time where there was the Senate was going to cut $20 million out of the public television budget. And so all these people had been reading statements to the Senate subcommittee. And so Mr. Rogers got up, and the crusty old senator, I think his name was Senator Posteri or something, said, I don't want to hear any more reading. I don't want any more. I've heard enough people reading. If you've got something to say, just say it. I don't want to hear you read it. And so Mr. Rogers very kindly said, well, you know, I wrote something, and it's really important to me, but you said you would read it, and I trust you that you will read it, but I would like to say what my program is about. And he started telling the senator about his program was about telling kids they were special and helping them know how to deal with important issues that were hard to talk about. And you could see the softening in the senator as Mr. Rogers spoke to him. And Mr. Rogers said to him, this is what I give. I give an expression of care every day to each child to help him realize he is unique. I talk about what do you do with your mad, and made up a song to help them deal with times when they are mad. I end the program by saying, you've made this a special day by just your being you. There's no person in the whole world like you, and I like you just the way you are. At the conclusion of Mr. Rogers' testimony, the senator said, I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. Looks like you just earned the $20 million. It was clear that Mr. Rogers' message of love and kindness had softened that senator's heart. Love abides. Now, one of the things I believe is that we are all connected, that there is an energetic field in which we live that connects and unites all of us. And I think physics now, quantum physics, which I don't know that much about, so I don't want to go down that path, but I think it's finding that to be true. And it explains a lot of what some people may think as woo-woo stuff that may just be based in the quantum realm. So I'd like to do a little demonstration, but I'm going to need some volunteers, and I'm hoping some of those high school folks in the back will come and help me demonstrate this. You guys back there are willing to come up and help me demonstrate, the young adults and high school folks? Okay, come on forward. About 10, I could use about 10. Yeah, just come on, be brave. Yeah, that's all right. You'll enjoy it, trust me. That's okay. Just come on up here. Just make a circle. Come on. Who else?
Yeah, Robin. Come on.
Okay, yeah, some adults. Show them how it's done. Come on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody? About 10 people. All right. Okay. So everybody grab hands. Okay, and we're going to have to close the circle here. What I have here is called an energy stick. Okay, and when it creates a connection, so what we're going to do is we're going to create that connection. All right, you ready? So I mentioned that I think that love can soften the hardest hearts. And I love movies. I'm a real movie lover. I subscribe to Netflix and Acorn TV and Google Prime and all those. And I love movies about redemption. These are movies where the main character generally gets on the wrong side of something, whether it be the law or his family or himself. He's lost in a spiritual desert. And somewhere along the way, love reaches his or her heart, and he or she does a 180 turnaround and is redeemed. I find those kind of movies hopeful. Hopeful from the standpoint that we may be lost at some point in our lives, but we can find our way back. And the way back is through love. And we have a loving God who always, always welcomes us back. One of my favorite redemption movies is Finding Forrester. It's an old movie. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. Sean Connery was in it, and he played a writer who had become a hermit. He had written this one amazing novel or story or book or something, and it was exalted. It was considered to be one of the best books ever written, and then he never wrote again. And he became this hermit. And he lived in an apartment about the fifth floor overlooking a basketball court in a primarily African-American neighborhood. And these African-American boys would be out playing basketball all the time, and they'd kind of look at this man that they'd occasionally see looking at birds or washing the outside of his window or something. And they thought he was some crazy, scary old man, and they used to dare each other to go up and knock on his door and that kind of thing. Well, one of the young men had gotten accepted to a very exclusive prep school in New York City based on his stellar test scores. His grades didn't reflect it, but his test scores showed that he had a lot of potential, and he received a scholarship. And so the other boys were kind of kidding him that he was going to move out of the neighborhood, he wasn't going to be one of them anymore. And so this daring thing started going on, I dare you to do this, and they dared him to go up and knock on the old man's door. And so he had to take on the dare, and up he went, took his backpack, knocked on the door, and then Sean Connery opened the door, this crusty man that didn't want to be bothered. And the kid was so startled, he took off. But he left his backpack behind, and it had all his homework, and it had his journals that he wrote in all the time. And so he got home and realized he didn't have his backpack, and he had to go back and get it. So he went back, and the backpack wasn't there. Sean Connery had taken it into his apartment. And so he knocks on the door, and ultimately he goes in to take his backpack. Sean Connery didn't answer, but the door wasn't locked or something. I can't remember the details. But anyway, he's in the apartment, and suddenly Sean Connery comes and finds him there, and he's like petrified, but he's also in awe of his library. Sean Connery has this amazing library. So long story short, the kid is writing, and he convinces Sean Connery to be his mentor. And so this whole story is about the relationship that builds between this young African-American boy who's struggling in an all-white exclusive prep school and Sean Connery, who doesn't want the world to even know anything because, of course, he's the famous author. And so I won't spoil it in case you want to watch it, but just know that at the end, there is redemption. And Sean Connery finally comes out and meets the public, and he does it out of love for this young man. So I love these kind of movies. There's also a great Bible story of redemption. Anyone know which one I'm talking about? What? The Prodigal Son. Very good. Just to freshen your memory of it a little bit, there's a man that has two sons. The younger son asked his father for his inheritance, which he takes and leaves for another land. There, the son squanders his inheritance on loose living and ends up starving and doing work, feeding another man's pigs, but no one gives him any food. And he finally realizes that if he returns to his father and says, "I'm not worthy of being your son. You gave me my inheritance. I squandered it. But I know you treat your servants better than I'm being treated, so just let me be your servant." That's what he's going to tell his father. So he heads home, and at a distance, his father sees him and rejoices and orders the servant to kill a fatted calf and make a feast and celebrate his son's return. He thought his son was dead, and he was overjoyed to find out he was still alive. Now, the older son, however, gets a bit grumpy about this, and he tells his father that, you know, all those years, while this younger son was out wasting his inheritance, I, the older son, I was a faithful one. I worked hard. I never caused any pain or grief, and yet you never killed a fatted calf for me. You never celebrated me. And I have to say, sometimes I identified more with the older son. I kind of felt like he got the short end of the stick in this story, but that was my own sense of justice, I think. But the father says to his son, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to make merry and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found." And Jesus goes on to say, the angels in heaven rejoice whenever a lost soul comes back into God. And that's comforting to know, and is at the heart of the redemption movies I love, that though you be lost, when you come back to love, you can be found. Love abides. Now, one of the other things that I loved in the Bible stories growing up was the story of the Good Samaritan. As I said, my belief was that the core of Jesus' teaching was to love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And so the passage in the Bible about the Good Samaritan is found in Luke chapter 10, verse 25 to 37. At one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "What is written in the law?" Jesus replied. "How do you read it?" Jesus answered, or the expert in the law answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." Jesus said, "You answered correctly. Do this and you will live." But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" In reply, Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came to where the man was, and when he saw him, took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil, and he put the man on his own donkey and brought him to an inn to take care of him. That next day, he gave the innkeeper some money and said, "Look after him, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." So Jesus asked the man, "Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers?" The expert in law said, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." Now, in those times, Samaritans were considered to be the outsiders. They were not the chosen. They were the outsiders. And Jesus was saying, "My love has no bounds. My love is not contained within the walls of these people. My love and your love, then, should extend to all people. Love abides." Now, this is the fact that I believe this doesn't necessarily mean I've mastered it. I know I have a long way to go at times. I can go into judgment with the best of them. And sometimes I succumb to the negativity that sometimes feels like it's swirling around us. But my hope is for myself that I learn more and more to stay in that place of love. But I also am challenged with, at what point do you stand up for justice, and how do you balance being a stand for justice and love at the same time? And that's one of my lessons that I'm trying to figure out for myself. One of the subsets of love is mercy. And I recently listened to an Audible book by Anne Lamott called Hallelujah Anyway, Rediscovering Mercy. Anne Lamott talks about mercy and the gift of mercy and grace. And she defines mercy as being something that is given without the recipient having to do anything to earn it. Grace was not a concept that we talked about a lot in the Methodist church that I grew up in. So it wasn't a concept I had a great deal of familiarity with over my lifetime. Lamott says, "Mercy involves absolving the unabsolvable, forgiving the unforgivable. Mercy brings us to the miracle of apology, given and accepted, to unashamed humility when we have erred or forgotten. Charge it to our heads and not our hearts, as the elders in black churches have long said. Mercy, grace, forgiveness, and compassion are synonymous, and the approaches we might consider taking when facing a big mess, especially a great big mess of ourselves, are arrogance, greed, poverty, disease, prejudice. It includes everything out there that just makes us sick and makes us want to turn away. The idea of accepting life as it presents itself and doing goodness anyway. The belief that love and caring are marbled even into the worst life has to offer." I was given a gift of mercy one time by a very close friend, someone I had known all my life. All the time I was growing up with her, I had compared myself to her, and I always came up short in my own mind. It didn't matter if it was schoolwork, it didn't matter if it was music, art, dance, athletics. I always compared myself to her and came up short in my mind. And what happened was, that was like a time capsule of poison building up in me, this feeling that I was never as good as her, or that even that I was comparing myself to her. And that time capsule laid in wait within me until one day it burst open and spewed out its poison. And that happened when I was talking with a friend who was a friend of both of ours. And in my conversation with him, all of a sudden I started venting all this poison and jealousy I had accumulated towards this friend. And this mutual friend told her everything I said. I said horrible, ugly things about her, things she didn't deserve, things that were from me. It was that ugly shadow side that sometimes comes out. So this friend of mine that I had known all my life phoned me, and she said, I want to come and talk with you. And she came, and she told me that this mutual friend had shared everything, and she said, I want to know if that's true. Did you say those things about me? And I said, yes, I did. I'm very ashamed that I did, but I did say those things, and I'm very sorry. I felt horrible. And she said, well, they hurt me very deeply that you felt this way about me. And I said, I am so sorry. And she said, I can tell that you're sorry, and I accept your apology. And she said, and now I want to tell you something. And she took my hands, and she looked me in the eye, and she said, Diana, I wish you could see yourself the way I see you. I wish you could see in you the beauty and the love that I see in you. I wish you could see that. And that's my hope for you, that you can love yourself. And I truly believe that is my life lesson here in this lifetime, is to learn to love myself. When I was a child, I had a sense of not being loved by my parents. Now, as an adult, I know they loved me. But back then, they weren't able to express it. They, as I said, were raised in the prairies of Canada, and they weren't very expressive. They weren't expressive at all. I don't ever remember as a child ever hearing the words, I love you, in our house. They weren't abusive. They never hit us, although they threatened to. But and my mother did wash out my mouth with soap one time when I called my sister a bad name. But when we were very little, my sister and I would always go out to my parents. They were usually out watching TV or talking in the living room. We'd go out and we'd say goodnight, Mommy and Daddy, and we'd give them a kiss and we'd go to bed. They didn't come in and tuck us in. They didn't come and read us bedtime stories. That was just our routine. And so one time, I think I was maybe about 7, I decided to test it. I didn't think I was loved, and I thought I would test it. So I didn't go out and say goodnight. I yelled it from my bedroom door, and I didn't go kiss them. And they said goodnight, and they never came, and they never said anything, and they never noticed, and then I quit even doing that. And that night, I started crying. And my sister called me a baby. She wasn't very sympathetic. And so I took my pillow into the closet and I stuffed my face in it and I sobbed my guts out, feeling that I wasn't loved. And a while later, my dad and I were having an argument and I made some comment about, well, I never asked to be born. And he said, well, we never asked to have you either. And my mother said, Bill. And he said, well, it's true. We already had a little baby. I was out of work. The last thing we needed was another child. And that just was a dagger in my heart and confirmed my worst fears. But I don't think that's the end of the story, because I believe that people come into our lives for a reason. I think Glenn Clark in The Divine Plan talks about that. And I think my parents played that role for me specifically so that I could learn to love myself. It's not that they didn't love me. It's that if I had grown up in a very loving family, I would never have had to learn that lesson for myself. And that's so important that we learn to love ourselves. And it's hard, as Carol said when she was sharing today the Agnes Sanford affirmations, it's hard to say sometimes, I love myself. I love me just who I am. And I think that's why Mr. Rogers' message was so powerful and even affected the hearts of the adults. When we really believe and know we are loved, and we can have such foundation in that, that we can love ourselves unconditionally, warts and all, it's so powerful. Love does abide. Many years after that, I was at a heart-opening workshop, and we were to do a meditation into our hearts and ask our hearts what they had to show us. I went into a very deep meditation, and in that meditation, I saw a house. And I went in the house and went up to the attic, and in the attic was this old set of dresser drawers. And I opened the first drawer, and there was an old crusty gym sock in there. And I lifted it out, and I thought, ugh. But I knew in my meditation this dresser drawer represented my heart. And that drawer and that crusty old gym sock represented some kind of pain that I had shut away. And then I opened another drawer, and there was another crusty old something or other in there. And that represented a much bigger pain, and that was taking up a whole drawer. So I asked my heart what that was, And my heart answered that this was the pain I carried about my belief that I was unlovable. And it was time to move that belief out of there. Following that meditation in this workshop, I was asked to go into another room of this place where the workshop was occurring, and a young man was sent to accompany me. And while he was young in years, I think he was a very old soul and filled with deep love and compassion. And as I shared with him my meditation, I started to cry. And this old pain was finally coming to the surface. And once it came, I couldn't stop the tears. And he just hugged me and said, "Let it all out." It was a big, ugly, snotty, blubbering cry, so big I could hardly breathe for the hold it had on me. It was like the dam burst that had been holding back the floodwaters. And as my sobbing subsided, he shared with me his own story of his father coming to the hospital the day he was born and saying he was too ugly to be his son and walking out and never coming back. At least my father hadn't abandoned me, not in the physical sense. And then this young man suggested that I go back into my childhood memories and I become the nurturing mother I didn't feel my mother had been to me. And so I did. I went back into a meditation and I started pulling up memories like the time the boy down the street dropped a worm down my boots one rainy day and I ran home crying to my mother and she said, "Oh, take it out and go back and play." Instead, in this meditation, I became the mother and I held my child self and I comforted that child self and I gave her love and I gave her understanding and I gave her comfort. And I did that with a few more childhood memories, and gradually those memories, they healed for me. Anne Lamott goes on to say, "Mercy gives us the chance to rediscover something both old and original, the sweet child in us who, all evidence to the contrary, was not killed off, but just put in the drawer. I realize now how desperately, how grievously I have needed the necessary mercy to experience self-respect. It is what a lot of us were so frantic for all along, and we never knew it. Love abides." In 1993, my mother died suddenly of a heart attack. I had seen her the month before at my sister and my birthdays in January when we all met at my sister's house to have dinner and celebrate. That weekend, a huge storm was projected to come in, and my dad was anxious to get on the road and take my mom home before it hit. But my mother really wanted to stay. She wanted to spend the night and celebrate with her daughters their birthdays. But my father had his mind made up, and he was stubborn, and he said no, they were leaving, and hurry up, open the presents so they could get going. And I, of course, argued with him, and all that accomplished was for him to dig in his heels more and upset my mother. As a result of that argument, I was very angry with my father. I saw him as being very self-centered and selfish and not really caring about my mother. And so in my anger, I didn't call my parents. I didn't want to talk to my dad, and so I didn't call them. And so several weeks went by until the morning I got the call from my dad that my mother had died in her sleep. And I had never talked to her again after that. And I was heartbroken and disappointed with myself that I had let my anger keep me from calling them. Later that spring, a friend invited me to a healing circle with her and a group of women, and that's where I met Diane Bush, as a matter of fact. We did a wonderful movement, and then we went into a silent meditation. And again, the silent meditation became very visual, and my mother appeared to me. And I was so excited to see her in this meditation, and I started to cry. And I told her I missed her, and she assured me she was there for me. And I continued crying, and she told me to stop my blubbering because she had something she needed me to promise her to do. And I asked her what that was, and she said, "It's about your father." And I said, I made some disparaging remark like, "Oh yeah, him." And she goes, "Now don't talk about your father that way." And I said, "Why? What did he ever do for you?" And she said, "He gave me the greatest gift any person could give another person." And I said, "What?" And she said, "He gave me 3 beautiful daughters." And of course, that made me cry harder, but she said, "Stop crying," as she needed to tell me something. And she said, "I want you to promise your dad is going to need your help and I want you to promise me that you'll be there for him. And I said, well, why is he going to need my help? And she said, I can't share that with you, but I just want you to promise me that you'll be there for him. And so I did. I promised her I would be there for him, not knowing what I was promising. And later that year, in late November, I noticed my father was limping. He didn't know why he was limping, but his legs seemed to be getting weaker. By Christmas, when he came down to my sister's house for Christmas, he had to use a cane to keep from tripping. He had been to the doctors, and they'd run a bunch of tests, but so far were unable to diagnose the problem. Then the following month, in January of 1994, Dad came down again to my sister's house to celebrate our birthdays, and by now he was having to use a walker. And then in March of that year, he fell, and he hit the back of his head on the corner of a china closet, and his legs were too weak to get up to call an ambulance. And so he just laid on the floor all night, bleeding from that wound in his head. His housekeeper arrived the next morning. He was able to get to the hospital. They had to give him several units of blood. And I went to see him right away in the hospital, and he was just as chipper as could be, and, oh, this is my daughter, and, oh, they're taking great care of me. But they still had no diagnosis for what was going on with him. And at this point, my oldest sister and I were taking turns going up to take care of him on weekends because he was no longer able to bathe himself. And finally, by May, the year he celebrated his 80th birthday, we had taken him to the UC Davis Medical Center to try and get a diagnosis, and they diagnosed him with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease. And he was in a wheelchair, his hands were starting to get weak, but his mind was still very clear and he was still able to talk. And he said to the doctor, well, okay, this is what Stephen Hawking has, and he's lived for quite a long time, maybe I can live for quite a long time, but I just want you to know if you need to use me for a guinea pig for any medications or anything, I'm open to doing that and offering himself up in the interest of science. But he continued to worsen, and by the end of July, he could no longer communicate. He couldn't be understood. His life had become living in his upstairs bedroom, bedridden. And during all those months of helping take care of him and bathing him, he never lost his sense of humor. He never once complained about his condition. He never told my sister or I that he wished we could spend more time with him. And I came to see a different person than what I had had him be. He was a really wonderful person. And I came to appreciate his gift of humor and his gift of positive attitude. And I had the chance to tell him that before he died. I had the chance to tell him how much I loved him and how much I appreciated all he gave to us, that we never had to worry about hunger or a roof over our heads, that he encouraged us all to go to college, that I loved his sense of humor. I loved the arguments we always seemed to get into because we disagreed on just about everything. And I got to tell him that. And the other thing I got to tell him, we always argued about psychic things and spiritual things. He had decided he was an atheist, and his belief was, once you die, that's it, lights out, curtains over, nothing left. I don't believe that. I believe that you go on, and I'm not sure what happens, but I had read a lot of books about this white light that pulls you into God's embrace and the embrace of those who have passed over before you. And so towards the end there in July, I told my dad, Dad, I want to say something to you, and I know if you could talk, you would disagree with me, but I believe when you die, you're going to see a white light, a bright white light. And I want you to promise me that you'll go to the light. If you see the light when you die, go to the light. And he was like, clearly. I said, I know if you could talk, you would disagree with me, and you are disagreeing with me. But just in case, Dad, I'm right and you're wrong. If you see a light, go to the light. That was at the end of July in 1994, and 4 days later, we got the call that he had passed on. Neither my sister nor I were with him, but his housekeeper was. And she said right before he died, he looked up at the corner of the room, he got a wonderful smile on his face, and then he left. I like to think that maybe he saw the light and thought, doggone it, she was right. Another movie I love is the movie Ghost. I don't know if you know that one, but it's about a man who gets murdered and he's coming back trying to communicate to his loved one, Molly, and Sam is his name. He says to Molly after he's been murdered, "It's amazing, Molly. The love inside you, you take it with you. Love abides." Thank you.
Thy kingdom come.